I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Prior to its publication, Flawless was well-reviewed, described as a must-read for true crime fans, a finely cut gem, well-polished and sparkling among other superlatives. It's a fascinating, gripping book about a weekend in 2003 when a group of thieves broke into a vault in the diamond capital of Antwerp in Belgium and stole nearly half a billion dollars in diamonds and other valuables. Not an alarm sounded, nor a shot fired, or anyone tied up or stuff like that, which you'd see in other caper stories. This book looks at the crime and the mystery surrounding it. While someone did go to jail, the loot and who else was part of this crime remains unknown. One of the authors of Flawless joins me now. Greg Campbell wrote Blood Diamonds, which inspired the movie, and co-authors this book with Scott Andrew Selby. Mr. Campbell joins me from Toronto this morning. He is an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in a number of publications, including The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, Paris Match, and The Christian Science Monitor. The book's full title is Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. It's published by Union Square Press, which is an imprint of Sterling. There's a website, flawlessbook.com. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Greg Campbell. Good morning, Mr. Campbell.
Hello, Joe. It's nice to speak with you.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And now, you're an expert at diamonds, far more than I am, so I'll ask you. Why Antwerp? Why is that the center of the diamond world?
That's actually a good question. It actually goes way back centuries, back to the 1400s, when Antwerp has kind of a really strategic geographic location for the flow of trades between the kind of Asian plateau and up through the Balkans and Eastern Europe and northward. And Antwerp is sort of situated in this really nice seaport along the Skeld River, so it's always sort of been kind of a hub for all kinds of different trade and commerce and art and culture. And it just so happened that Antwerp craftsmen were the first ones to invent the modern manufacturing process. They're the first to perfect the techniques of actually cutting rough stones using other diamonds into these kind of beautiful polished shapes that we know and treasure today. So that's kind of where this special skill really took hold. And so ever since the early 1400s, people have kind of flocked to Antwerp to have their jewelry fashioned. And so just over time, it's slowly retracted into its current boundaries where this crime took place, inside the Diamond Square Mile.
And what is that? That's a series of buildings? There's a map in the book, but for people who don't see the map.
Yeah, it's a small little district. It's basically three streets that are lined up end-to-end at 90-degree angles, and there are buildings on all sides of the streets. And it's a very narrow little area. It's actually much smaller than I think a lot of people might imagine, especially when you consider that 80% of all the diamonds that are found in the world by value usually go through these little three streets here. And the Diamond District, as it's called, is heavily secured. It's got vehicle barricades at either entrance on both sides, so traffic can't just freely go through. It requires police clearance. There is a round-the-clock, heavily armed security force, both private guards and official city police. And kind of as the icing on the cake, there's a network of closed-circuit television cameras that literally cover every angle around the clock, so you can't sneak into the Diamond District.
Now, you tried to sneak in once, I understand, and set off the alarm?
No alarms. I set off, I set off some personal alarms among the building's management, but indeed, yeah, I did actually sneak down myself I wasn't really sneaking, I just wanted to see if it could be done. This vault that was robbed in 2003 supposedly was impenetrable, and these guys proved that it certainly wasn't. But I wanted to just see for myself, go down and visit the scene of the crime and just see if it was even possible to walk around a little bit down in this restricted area. So I had an appointment with one of the tenants in the building, and when I concluded my interview, I just got in the elevator, and it was simply as easy as pushing the correct button in the elevator. And so sure enough, the doors slid open, and I managed to walk around. I didn't push my luck very, very far. I wandered around for just a few seconds. I knew I was being observed by the closed-circuit television cameras, so I just took a couple of mental notes and wanted to see the space for myself so that I could inform my reporting when I wrote about it. Got back up and was congratulating myself on, having gotten away with it. And I wasn't out of the elevator for 5 minutes before the building manager kind of swooped on me and wanted to know who I was, what I was doing, how dare you go down into the vault. But no alarms.
Yeah. So how did, I mean, they knew you were there, but on the 15th of February, someone was down there.
Yes.
And they never saw that or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. And to kind of draw a picture of what this vault is like, to give you an idea of the security level, it's first of all located, as I said, two floors underground. There's really only one way in or out of the vault level. The vault door itself is about a foot thick. It's made of steel, and it has two locking mechanisms, one with a key and one with a combination code with 100 million possibilities for the combination. And on the outside of the door, there is a magnetic alarm. So the two parts of the magnet join together and create a magnetic field when the door is closed. So if the door is opened at any time when it's not supposed to be, an off-site security company would be alerted, and the cops would be called immediately. Now, inside the room, there is a motion detector, an infrared heat detector, and a light sensor. And laced throughout all the concrete walls are seismic detectors, so that if somebody tried to cut through the wall or tunnel in from below, that would also set off an alarm. Now, if that weren't daunting enough, there is 189 safe deposit boxes inside this room, and each of those were also double-locked with both a key and a unique combination for each one of those. So these guys managed to, the people we're talking about, a group of Italian criminals that are known as the School of Turin, which is from Turin, Italy, where they're based. And they managed to get in on the night of the crime. They infiltrated the building, and they systematically went around each one, or sabotaged each one of these individual security elements, so that they could basically have the run of the vault for several hours before making off with as much loot as they could carry. And in fact, the crime wasn't even discovered until Monday morning, so it was some 24 hours later.
So there's no footage on the security cameras or anything like that that exists, right?
No. And the reason, if I can explain the footage on the security cameras, because it kind of goes to the heart of what these guys found as a main weakness on all of these different security measures, which was kind of human error or a little bit of a slack attitude about security among the staff. And even though the building was equipped with cameras and the cameras monitored 24 different locations, including the vault, around the clock, and they were being recorded on videotape, nobody actually physically watched the monitors. There's no guard in charge of sitting in a booth, you know, and you know, eating snacks throughout the middle of the night and trying to stay awake, drinking coffee while he's watching these empty monitors. They're turned off, as a matter of fact. So getting away with the evidence was simply a matter of breaking into the security control booth where they picked the lock and removing the videotapes, and they took them with them.
Has that changed? Has any of the security changed there?
You know, I can only presume that some measures of the security infrastructure have changed. The building ownership and management is not discussing what... First of all, they're not discussing anything.
Yeah.
They haven't talked about the crime ever, and they're actively avoiding any conversations about it with journalists. They're, of course, speaking to the law enforcement. But the presumption is that they must have made some changes to the security measures, but there are others that that I'm certain haven't changed, and as a point in fact, the door itself, the big vault door, worked perfectly fine. It functioned exactly as it was supposed to. There was nothing wrong with it. They didn't damage it. They didn't manage to open the door by breaking it or unscrewing it or doing anything strange like that. So the door is exactly the same as the door it was when the thieves broke in.
So Leonardo, I don't know how to pronounce it, Notarbartolo?
Pretty close. Notarbartolo.
Notarbartolo. He arrives when? This is probably in 2002, right? He goes there and takes out a lease for a space there?
Yeah, and he actually started much sooner than that. It was late 2000 when he first rented an office there. And just as another illustration of how the staff kind of, you know, aided in an unwilling or unwitting way, they didn't require any type of a criminal background check on Notarbartolo when he rented his office there. He simply went in and filled out a lease application and paid the rent, and they gave him the keys to the castle. So he spent the better part of 2 years looking around, playing the part of this mild-mannered Italian jeweler who, you know, is just kind of there to buy some diamonds every once in a while for his businesses down in Italy. And really what he was doing was walking around through the halls and taking really close stock of all the different security elements. And he was looking at things such as the brand of the door that they, so that their locksmiths would know what type of locking mechanisms they would have to deal with. They would, he would take pictures, surreptitious pictures and videotapes of the motion detectors, and he observed the staff to learn what their habits were and what their general policies were. So he spent a great deal of time and a lot of patience assembling all this information.
And he had a record already, right?
Oh, yeah. He was quite well known among the law enforcement officers in Italy. It probably wouldn't have rang any bells if the Belgian police had looked at their records, because he was clean in Belgium. Excuse me. But he was quite a colorful record, including auto theft. He'd done some time for other jewelry robberies. Small potato stuff. It resulted in a few months here and a few months there throughout most of his adult life, but nothing on the scale of what he pulled off in 2003.
Do you have an idea of how many people were involved in all this?
The police, their best estimate is that, and this is based on cell phone records, because they managed to, once they tracked these guys down, they managed to locate some cell phones that they used on a closed cell phone network. And they believe that there are as many as 7 or 8 people who were fully involved in robbing the Diamond Center. And at the end of the day, they ended up identifying 4 of them, and all 4, including Oda Bartolo, were eventually arrested and incarcerated.
And then the diamonds in the loop has never been recovered, right?
Nope, not a single stone. They've never found a single diamond that was connected to the heist.
Now, Oda Bartolo was arrested. He served his time. And he was discovered recently driving around in a BMW, and they found some diamonds in it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The police were very open with us before Oda Bartolo was released, about their intentions to keep a close eye on him and the others when they were released, just to see if they might lead them to the mother lode one of these days. And sure enough, Oda Bartolo was suspicious as soon as he got out of prison, because he was suddenly seen driving around Italy in this brand-new BMW Sportster. And for a guy fresh out of prison, that raised a couple of flags. So he was pulled over by the traffic police in Milan so that they could just take a look around and question what he was doing. And inside the car, they found about 1 kilogram of rough and polished diamonds. And, of course, everybody's alarm bells went off and said, well, this could be part of the heist. This could be tied to the big crime. And so it took a long time. There's a lot of bureaucracy that has to get cut through between Italy and Belgium. But eventually, the Belgian experts managed to get their hands on these diamonds, and they ran them through a series of tests and analysis to see if they matched any of the diamonds that were known to be stolen from the crime. And at the end of the day, they couldn't conclude whether any of them were or not. And it's not necessarily surprising. There were only a small handful of diamonds could be 100% identified from the victims, from the people who'd lost them. Many people didn't even realize what they had in their safe deposit boxes when they were robbed. So, the list of known diamonds is very small compared to the overall take. So when they conducted this analysis, it was basically inconclusive. But Oda Bartolo was released and allowed to go along his way. I believe they still have the diamonds in Belgium, and I believe they're still running some sort of analysis on them.
And he can't, if he confesses even to it, he can't be put in jail, or can he?
No, he couldn't. He served his time. He was found guilty. He spent 6 years in prison before he was released as a beneficiary of an early release program. He cannot be tried or thrown in jail again for this crime. They might be able to find, if they found irrefutable proof that he had in his possession one of the diamonds or several of the diamonds that were known to be stolen, they might be able to make a case as in terms of something like possession of stolen property. But I don't think that would carry a very big penalty. And it would require, a great deal of kind of bureaucratic cooperation between the courts in Belgium, which would file the charges, and the courts in Italy, which would be charged with then arresting him and making sure he goes and serves his time or faces the charges up in Belgium. So it's kind of a lot of red tape to get through for what probably wouldn't be a very, very big penalty.
Have you tried to talk to him?
Yeah, in fact, I did speak with him.
Yeah.
Before he was released, first of all, one of the first things that Scott Selby, my co-author, and I did was to send letters to all these men and their attorneys and express interest in speaking with them and described our project, what we were doing. And we eventually heard back in one form or another from all of them, but Oda Bartolo invited us to come and meet with him face-to-face. And we sat down, and so I went into the prison as a visitor, and I met with him. and I spoke with him for about an hour, and it was sort of a fruitless interview. He and I were trying to negotiate whether or not he would cooperate and tell me a story, and you know, we never came to an agreement on that because he was ironically looking for money. He wanted to be paid very handsomely for his cooperation, and that just wasn't something that I was willing to do.
Now, have you and Selby, have you given any thought that this could be an inside job, that there were people perhaps part of the Diamond Center who were in on this?
Sure, yeah. You know, there's a lot of theories about that, as a matter of fact, because only, you know, there's a couple of mysteries that still remain about how these guys managed to get around certain individual elements of the crime. And the most intriguing one is this combination dial on the outside of the big vault door, because it's, like I said, 100 million possible combinations, and there's no way that they're just going to guess or, you know, kind of do like they do in the movies, you know, with a stethoscope and listen for the clicks and the clacks. It just doesn't work that way. In real life, it would have taken much, much longer to break in than they did at the time. So the big mystery is, how did they learn this combination? Because the correct one was put on at some point before the door was opened. Like I said, they didn't do any type of elaborate subterfuge. They actually knew the code. So the question then becomes, you know, who on the staff knew the code? And there are four people on the staff who knew this code to the combination, and they went straight to the top of the list of suspects. And the police interrogated them relentlessly during the initial days of the investigation. And at the end of the day, they just couldn't find any evidence that there was any inside cooperation. Although there's a lot of people who were victims of the crime or who were related to it peripherally in one way or another, who still really do believe that one of the people inside the building who knew the combination must have assisted them in some way.
Now, this was the perfect crime, almost, save for some garbage that was thrown out of the car.
Yeah, you know, it was flawless, which is the title of the book. It was flawless in the sense that the caper went perfectly. They pulled off the crime without any hitch. Their plan worked to perfection, and they made off, walked out the door without anybody knowing, vastly enriched compared to when they walked in. What was less flawless was their getaway plan, because the heist has generated a lot of garbage, a lot of incriminating evidence. They had rubber gloves with their DNA on it. They had, you know, all kinds of just refuse from the tools that they had purchased, and they needed to get rid of all this stuff, and they wanted it permanently. They needed to get rid of it for good. So somebody made the bad mistake of opting to throw it into this forest on the side of the road near Brussels as they were making their getaway to Italy. And at first glance, it looked like not a bad decision. Yeah, I've been to the forest, and it's indeed very dense, and you know, it's off the highway, so it's not in an area where people would be likely to stop and might notice it or even care if they saw it. So it seemed like a really good idea. But what they didn't know was that this particular stand of woods was patrolled day in and day out by this retired grocer who had taken up, you know, kind of as his, you know, kind of retirement hobby, keeping the forest clean.
Right.
So he was there every single day, annoying himself to no end by you know, going into the trees and finding litter. He'd always find a beer bottle or wine bottles or cigarette butts or something that's been thrown out of the cars as he goes by. And sure enough, you know, couldn't miss it. He found the heist garbage, and the evidence that the police collected from those garbage bags led them directly to the four guys that were identified.
They had their DNA in the garbage, I guess, right?
Well, there was DNA evidence that they found. There was also documentary evidence. For instance, when they were breaking into the safe deposit boxes, they did not break into Dr. Bartolo's box. So they knew that box was sealed and that anything that was found in the garbage wouldn't have come from any of the sealed boxes. But they did find some documents with his company's name on it. So then they suddenly, you know, okay, that's curious. I wonder why, you know, where did this come from if not from from the Diamond Center. So Notre Bartolo quickly became a suspect, and they also identified a couple of the other thieves through some of the other bits of rubbish that they found there.
So all the five of them then have all served time now?
There are four, yes. They've all served time. They served various sentences. Because Notre Bartolo was sort of he was presumed to be the ringleader of this gang, because he kind of had the deepest involvement. He was known to have been actively involved in plotting this thing for at least 2 years. So he was sentenced to a total of 10 years in prison, and the three others were sentenced to 5 years each. And it took them all various amounts of time to actually get arrested. Italy wasn't very cooperative about extraditing all of it, you know, citizens for a nonviolent crime. So it took a lot of, kind of, as I keep referring to, bureaucratic back and forth between the courts. But eventually, all four of them were nabbed. And Notre Bartolo did the most time. He served about 6 years. and the other three served between 2 and 3 years each. Some of them did their time in Italy, and some of them did their time in Belgium.
How do you think we'll ever find out what happened?
Well, you know, that was actually our goal. Our goal was to get as close as we possibly could without physically having been there, you know, during the commission of the crime. And I think we got about 95% of the way there. I mean, there are still, there's one or two little details, like I said, the combination being one, and there's maybe one or two other small minor matters. But the way that we describe the crime in the book is the way that I think it most likely occurred. You know, we really went to meticulous lengths to research this and to make sure that what we were representing was backed up by facts or the opinions of people, you know, smart people who would know. So we really triangulated all these different areas to come up with this one composite piece. And it was a really fascinating project to work on because there was no one place to go to that would tell you the whole story. In other words, it wasn't all written out in a police report. The cops were cooperative, but only up to a certain point. They didn't want to let all the details out. So we had to really think like, you know, thieves and detectives ourselves when we pieced this thing together.
And where were you on the 15th of February, 2003?
I don't know. That's I haven't even established my own alibi. That's a very good point. Maybe I ought to do that before I do many more of these interviews.
Yeah. How did you and Selby get together to do this?
Yeah, you know, Scott lives in Sweden. He's an American, but he lives in Sweden full-time. And when the heist occurred, he had heard about it. Obviously, it was all over the news in Europe. It didn't make as big of a splash here in the United States. So he started researching it within a year of the heist. He just thought it would make engrossing story that he just knew it would make a really good book. So he began running down sources and leads and getting together a book proposal. And I was approached to assist because of my background with conflict diamonds and writing blood diamonds, and because of my publishing experience as well. So we teamed up. We made a really, really good team. I kind of brought the journalism skills to the table, and he brought a really meticulous level of research to it.
And has the book been optioned?
Not yet. It's available if anybody is interested, but it's certainly making its way around Hollywood. I know that. And there's been a couple sparks of interest, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed because I think it would make a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it would. Yeah. And now, Nota Bartolo, he's cashed in on this, right?
He has. He's apparently sold his part of this story, you know, his version of events. He has sold the option to make a movie to Paramount, is my understanding. So he was finally able to get the financial benefit he was looking for that he couldn't get from me when he was trying to see if I would pay for the big interview.
The reaction to the book has been pretty good, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. So far, it's been all the reviews have been raves. They've been very more than fair, and I think it's just a real reflection on the story itself because it's just such a compelling crime and it's such a fascinating story. That, I mean, even I enjoy reading it, and that says something, because I usually can't stand to read what I've written for at least a year or 2 years after the fact. But I still get engrossed in it, because it's just such a good story. And like I said, we really went to vast pains to really track down every lead we could and really try to nail the story to the wall and make sure that we got it as close as we could. I think it's as close as it can get until Nota Bartolo, or one of the thieves, wants to come completely clean and discuss exactly how it happened with all the bruises and all, warts and bruises and everything.
Well, are you working on something else now?
I just started my next project, actually. I'm researching a book about medical marijuana in the United States, and it's kind of a cresting wave at this point. There are 14 states in the U.S. that allow the use of medical marijuana, and in some states, it's really being pushed into the mainstream with the eye on the horizon towards full either legalization or at least a drastic decriminalization of marijuana in the United States. So it's a pretty cool time in history that I'm looking forward to documenting.
Congratulations to you and Scott on this book. I haven't finished it yet, but I'm just a quarter of the way through it, and I'm just really looking forward to finishing it.
Well, thank you very much. I hope you enjoy it, and this has been fun speaking with you.
Thanks very much. The website for more is flawlessbook.com. The title of the book is Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. Union Square Press is its publisher. That's an imprint of Sterling. The book is written by Scott Andrew Selby and Greg Campbell. Greg Campbell on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.